live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
Good morning. It is right before the top of the hour at 11 o'clock. And coming up is Stage and Studio. It's a presentation of Crossing East Relations, a radio documentary by Demay Roberts about the historic and current relationships between Asian Americans and African Americans. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Stage and Studio is made possible by KBOO members and support from PD Expendables, Stage and Studio Supplies. PD Expendables sells and rents to film and theater production, from gel and globes to paint and lights, featuring the latest Airy LED lighting. They can be reached at 503-887-5880 or their online store at pdexpendables.com.
I'm Demay Roberts. These are divisive times. Through the last few decades, some progress has been made in creating a more diverse and inclusive society. Some progress. Not enough. But some. Since the 2016 presidential election, racial divisions in America have become more visible, and racists have been emboldened, and hate crimes are on the rise. There always has been a great need for us to listen to each other, not talk over each other to make divisive points, but to truly listen to marginalized groups and discussions about racism. But this isn't a story about black and white tensions. It's about relationships between two marginalized groups that have historically been pitted against each other. Asian Americans and African Americans haven't always worked together as well as we could. Most of the time, Asians have been singled out as a model minority to create a wedge against other racial groups. This is a story of that history and the surprising ways both groups are reaching out toward each other, and we'll be taking a look at younger generations working to eradicate the biases between these two groups with a new level of activism by getting together and talking to each other and then taking action. This is Crossing East Relations. Here's some history. In 2006, Meteorites created and broadcast the first Asian Pacific Islander, or API, history series on public radio. The series ran on 230 stations around the country. We had more than 50 scholars, radio producers, and artists working to produce 8 hours that covered API history from the land bridge across Asia to North America to racial profiling right after September 11, 2001. After the 10th anniversary of the series, Meteorites decided to create an archive of more than 100 hours of oral history interviews that we recorded. At the same time, I embarked on a new documentary, this one. Initially, it would be from the archive material, but then I re-listened to some prophetic interviews that speak to events in the last few years, to voices discussing the Los Angeles riots.
Right now, rescue 27.
Everybody's going crazy right now. Like the black gangs, the white gangs, the Korean gangs, anybody could drive up right now.
Probably two-thirds of South Central Los Angeles has been incarcerated or had some type of incarceration. The kids and the adults in these communities suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and hypervigilance. This is a war zone.
After the Rodney King verdict on April 29, 1992, there were 3 days and four nights of demonstrations, civil disobedience, rioting, looting, and arson. The riots ended with 55 people dead, nearly 2,300 injured, and another 10,000 arrested. When we were creating a radio story about the L.A. riots, we heard from African-American activist Akilah Shirelles in Los Angeles, who made this statement foreshadowing events to come.
I think that the L.A. riot was a precursor to something else that hasn't happened yet within the culture. I think that this country is actually headed for a civil war. And I think that we are being totally emotionally desensitized to violence against one another. I think that we're being pitted against each other on a large scale. The LA riot was a sign that unless we focus our energy and efforts on helping people to address the deep wounds within our own personal life that we're going to see this whole country destroyed.
Akilah Sherrill's statement about deep wounds in 2005 rings true today, given the amount of police violence against African Americans caught on video in the last few years. The killing of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman and the deaths by police of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Alton Sterling, Akai Gurley, and Philando Castile intensified an ongoing movement for Black lives. Through the years, class disparity has increased. And I listened to another prophetic comment from the Crossing East series, this one from Angela Oh, a Korean-American teacher and attorney who gained national prominence as a voice for the Korean-American community. As Angela Oh spoke up for Koreans whose stores were being burned to the ground during the 1992 LA riots, she also made this prediction.
The fact of the gap between the wealthy and the poor growing, except now we're talking on a global scale. If anything's going to happen, it's going to happen in a place like Los Angeles, New York, Washington, D.C. And so if people are feeling that they want to work and they can't because there's just nothing, and if our housing crisis continues, if we continue on where people do not have access to health care, if we continue on where our solution to dealing with problems in our community is to jail young people for long periods of time without any program for rehabilitation, without any thinking that these are young people that are going to come back to our communities, we're just asking for another 1992.
During the LA riots or uprising, as it's come to be known, or in Korean, Saigu, which translates to April 29th, conflicts between African Americans and Korean Americans intensified. Throughout American history, marginalized groups have often been pitted against each other by the mainstream establishment. After listening again to Akilah Sherrill's and Angela Oh's foreshadowing statements in the Crossing East archive, I decided to do more listening and gather new recordings from activists, community scholars, and community members in Oregon and the Bay Area to answer these questions. Why have these two communities been pitted against each other? How can African-American and Asian-American communities work together? And how are younger activists building upon the groundwork of veteran activists to resist the attempts to divide us? Finally, how can we listen? The LA uprising in the 1990s was a catalyst for Asian American communities to look at ways to work with African American communities. But the relationship between these two marginalized groups goes back much further. One of the main scholars for the Crossing East series, Jadeep Singh, recommended I talk with Anirvan Chatterjee in the Bay Area.
For me, growing up in the U.S., I actually didn't really kind of get any kind of a sense from school or from my larger American community that there was any kind of connection at all between African Americans and South Asians. I mean, those connections were something that I actually learned more from my Indian community, my South Asian community, that my parents or other people around me would say, well, of course, you know, like the Black Civil Rights Movement, they learned so much from Gandhi, you know, like, and that was something that folks were really proud of.
Anirvan Chatterjee is one of the curators of the Berkeley South Asian Radical History Walking Tour. He is also one of the co-creators of the site BlackDesiSecretHistory.org that traces the history of South Asian and African American solidarity. Chatterjee has traced this relationship that began in the 17th and 18th centuries.
These were South Asians who were coming to the U.S. as indentured servants and in some cases literally as slaves. I mean, there's records of runaway slaves who are marked as East Indian, like back in like 1768 and kind of in that period. So we can only imagine like what it might have been for these South Asians to be in African-American spaces, what kind of connections they made.
Chatterjee says following that initial migration came the Bengali Harlem, documented in a book and film by historian Vivek Bald.
And in it, he describes how from like the, say, the 1880s through, say, the 1930s or so, there was wave after wave after wave of folks from Bengal, largely the present-day nations of Bangladesh and to some extent Indian Bengal, who would be coming as traders to the United States, to the East Coast. And they would fan out up and down, going to places like Detroit, New York City, New Jersey. And they would often be peddlers. They'd be selling goods that they'd brought over with them from India. White communities would not have them. So they very quickly actually started connecting with and often marrying into Black communities. Black and Creole and Puerto Rican communities. There's a story of one Bengali man, for example, who married somebody who was literally the daughter of a slave. And just thinking about like what those conversations would have been like for somebody to be like, you know, these two people from like such entirely different worlds living together, having children and kind of going on through life. So for me, like that's kind of the moment when South Asians came to the United States in large numbers, in largish numbers relative to before. And we found comfort and we kind of found safety in Black America.
After the Bengali Harlem, Chatterjee says another wave of South Asian and African American relations started in the 1930s to 1940s. Indians were not only dealing with independence from the British Empire, but with a caste system often based on color.
Suddenly, African Americans start noticing India, and they see India as this nation of colored people who are resisting white empire. And in that process of resisting white empire, I mean, they were kind of really formulating new models on what it looks like to resist white imperialism. And there's all these statements and quotes and writing that we found where Black Americans really saw that as something that really kind of inspired them as well. Because if these colored people abroad could be working for their liberation, African America might be able to do that too. And my favorite thing that kind of came out of this was, it's 1942. It's the, you know, like it's the middle of World War II. And the NAACP could have been working on so many things, but they'd had some connections with a couple of Indian activists, and they came together and they put out this like large resolution, and they got thinkers and writers and poets to put out this entire package of supporting materials, really demanding freedom and autonomy for India, because they saw their liberation wrapped up in the liberation of India. Now, when I say India, this is the present-day nations of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. But my favorite kind of piece from that time is a poem from by Langston Hughes called How About It? And it reads, in part, "Show me that you mean democracy, please. Because from Bombay to Georgia, I'm beat to my knees. You can't lock up Nehru, club Roland Hayes, then make fine speeches about freedom's way." And it gave me chills reading that for the first time, seeing him talk about the first Prime Minister of India, Nehru, who was at the time a political prisoner captured by the British, and talking about a black man who was a victim of police brutality in the same poem, in the same sentence.
Chatterjee was personally inspired by activist Bayard Rustin's actions in India when the country gained freedom from the British Empire in 1947. Rustin is best known as the organizer of the 1963 March on Washington.
So in 1949, Bayard Rustin, who was risking arrest in D.C. to make sure that these, you know, Indian freedom fighters would actually be able to like oust the British from their country, he goes to visit India and he ends up meeting his fellow anti-colonial leader, who is now the Prime Minister of India. And there's this like beautiful photo of the two of them, just Nehru and Bayard Rustin hanging out and talking. And again, that's one of these photos that I wish every South Asian could see, just, you know, to see this like gay Black activist who was the right-hand man of Martin Luther King hanging out and talking to somebody who's actually really important for Indians, at least, our first prime minister. But this is where it gets interesting, because we were talking about MLK's visit to India in 1959, and that was something that was organized by Bayard Rustin as well. So in 1959, Martin Luther King goes to India, and he talks to Nehru, and he talks to other people there. And a lot of the folks who are going to India, Black American leaders who are going to India from the U.S., they'd be meeting these former anti-colonial freedom fighters who were the new government, and they would show up and they would sometimes realize that, I mean, this is great, you know, we're actually meeting the leaders of this nation of like hundreds of millions of people, but maybe Black America wasn't exactly in the same position as these new national leaders. And they started actually making connections with Dalit communities, and they started realizing that race and caste in many cases worked really similarly.
Chatterjee says this early solidarity between India's independence movement and the Black Liberation Movement directly connects with solidarity of Asian Americans for the current Black Lives Matter movement.
For over a century, South Asians have been standing with African America. African America has been standing with South Asia. And the cultures of resistance that have come out of that are it's a very best part of our tradition, and we just need to be able to step up and say that is something that we need to be able to teach and share. And I'm really hopeful that for younger generations of South Asian Americans, that's a tradition that they too can step into.
That was Anirvan Chatterjee, co-creator of the site BlackDesiSecretHistory.org, where you can find a history of South Asian and African American solidarity. You're listening to Relations, a documentary special for the Crossing East Archive Project. Throughout this hour, we're featuring music from Portland musician David Ornette Cherry. Hear more of his music at davidornettecherry.com. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. For more info on this documentary and the archive, visit crossingeast.org. The myth that Asians are somehow a community that has risen to success despite hard circumstances has been held up as something to emulate. Man, the model minority myth has caused so many problems for API communities, especially when it comes to getting along with other marginalized groups. Now, we heard about the early solidarity between African American leaders and South Asians, but the Immigration Act of 1965 changed the landscape of cross-cultural relationships. On the one hand, more Asian family members and skilled workers could freely immigrate to the U.S. and create more family unification. But in the late 1960s and till this day, an idea emerged to elevate Asians as the model minority.
In the 1960s, this idea of Asian Americans as a model minority is picked up by conservative media and by conservative politicians, and is used as an argument against civil rights for African Americans, basically. And particularly, not the idea of civil rights or legal inclusion, but particularly programs to help to resolve the legacy of racial inequality faced by African Americans in that period. So programs like busing and affirmative action, for instance.
Scott Nakagawa is an activist and writer. He founded a racial justice think tank called Change Lab, and he's written extensively about the model minority myth.
And so the case is made through talking about specifically at first the Japanese American community, that this is a community that was horribly persecuted, that started out in poverty, and within a couple of generations is now assimilating to the white middle class, has integrated itself into middle class suburbs and communities around America, and is enjoying an average family income that is comparable to that of middle class families in the United States, regardless of race.
This myth quickly became a way to first pit Japanese Americans and then Chinese Americans and each subsequent Asian group that immigrated against other minority groups, particularly African Americans. And the myth is still used by mainstream media, especially when talking about economic disparity in communities of color. Nakagawa says the Asian American model minority myth makes the case that minorities can pursue the American dream despite racial inequity.
The model minority basically suggests that Asians by culture, or in some instances even by biology, have a greater disposition toward success, value education more, work hard, are quiet, uncomplaining, cooperative, and are willing to make sacrifices in order to achieve a better life. It's hard to describe the model minority except in terms of what it's not. The model minority is not prone to criminality, not prone to protest, not disruptive, and willing to basically quietly work and do as they're told.
But when you look at the highest median family incomes of all groups in the U.S., many Asian Pacific Islanders are near poverty level. Nakagawa stresses it's APIs who arrive with college degrees and who are in the professional classes of workers that have higher incomes. He says the model minority concept is a story about labor.
Basically, what the model minority has done is class Asian Americans is highly exploitable managerial class laborers, right? Wage earners, not owners. And, you know, with the kinds of characteristics that make you perfectly exploitable, you don't complain, you don't protest, you're quiet, you're cooperative, you work really hard, you allow your identity to be as subsumed within the goals of the group, right? Really good team players with technical skills and proficiency and a really low error rate. And so the whole idea of race is one that originally is justified by ideas about culture and biology that were not actually things that people understood prior to, you know, the age of slavery in the United States and around that time. It's a very recent phenomena, and in the United States is a particularly American character to white supremacy.
Asian Americans have not historically shown support for African Americans. While there have been many times that African Americans and Asian Americans have worked together to fight discrimination and injustice, Nakagawa says those are the exceptions.
Well, throughout most of history, Asian Americans and African Americans have not stood up with each other. Right. Asian Americans in particular have tried to make the argument for citizenship historically by basically arguing that they aren't black. So, you know, when we talk about race in the United States, race and citizenship always go together. And so the fight for inclusion is a fight for citizenship rights. It is that even amongst undocumented immigrants today. Undocumented immigrants are a class of workers in the United States.
Yet Nakagawa thinks there are people challenging the model minority myth, especially a new generation of Asian American activists rising into leadership.
Well, there have been waves of activism throughout our history since the 60s against this idea of the Asian American model minority that's led by Asian Americans themselves. I think today the difference is that what people are reaching for is a kind of solidarity politic that would join together Asian Americans with other people of color in order to challenge white supremacy in the United States. And so there's a lot of promise there. What I think that in terms of solidarity we need to do is that we need to recognize that those instances when Asians and African Americans and other people of color have risen up together are exceptional moments in U.S. history. Most of the time, that's not what's happening. There's disunity, dissension, and tension, right? That's the normal state of things. And so we should be focusing not so much on the exceptional, which are, you know, circumstances that are often created by history, right? The historical accidents of those times, but on what's normal and try to understand what holds us in this state of disunity.
You can read Scott Nakagawa's essays on Race Files, a blog by Change Lab. I'm Dime Roberts. This is Relations, a documentary special for the Crossing East Archive Project. Check out more at crossingeast.org. Listening to Chinese Americans in New York City protesting the conviction of Officer Peter Liang. On November 20th, 2014, Akai Gurley was shot by a police officer, Peter Liang, in a stairwell in New York City. Gurley was 28 years old, African American, and unarmed. This was another of many police shootings of African-American men. Peter Leung was a 27-year-old Chinese-American officer with less than 18 months of experience. He was convicted of manslaughter and official misconduct on February 11, 2016, but he was later given probation and community service. Some in the Chinese community believe this was a case of scapegoating because no white police officer to date has been prosecuted for shootings of unarmed African-American men. Most of the protests around the country came from first-generation Asian Americans. Asians who wanted to protest were simply not talking to the African-American community and only knew their own perspective. Meanwhile, in Portland, Helen Ying was hearing about plans of another protest.
This is what I learned from the local leader. You know, this is how he put it. He says, this is a officer, a young officer, whose parents don't even speak English. And when he was being tried, his parents couldn't even come to the trial, to the court, because they have to work.
Helen Ying is the National Vice President of Membership in the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. She spent many hours trying to explain the Peter Leung verdict to outraged Chinese immigrants, both in America and in China, who communicated through WeChat, the Chinese version of Facebook. One was a member of her organization who wanted to hold a protest rally in Portland.
So basically he's saying, you know, that this officer didn't even get like really the time of day, because his parents, you know, they don't have the means, they might not even have been able to hire a lawyer that could represent him well.
This divided younger generations of Asian Americans who thought police officers should be held accountable no matter what.
And so what we have seen like online is a lot of Mandarin speaking, you know, folks who are newer immigrants from mainland China that are having this kind of response. And because a lot of the information they have received are from, you know, Chinese written language media.
When protests were being organized around the country in support of Peter Leung, Ying worked to connect the rally organizer with leaders in the African-American community to understand their perspective.
So when I got wind of this, I contacted our national network, you know, and like our national president says, hey, this is what's happening in Portland. What are you guys hearing about what's going on in other parts of the country? And so long story short, there was no incident, and one of the leaders, Teresa Rayford, from Hands Up, Don't Shoot, that's the name of their group, she actually came and spoke at the rally alongside of other speakers that are Chinese Americans.
Younger Asian Americans were shocked. Portland activist Jenny Chu attended a workshop created by the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO. It's a statewide grassroots social justice organization. The workshop helped her to unpack her discomfort about Asians rallying for a police officer.
It was actually so alarming for me as someone that grew up in Oregon to see a whole entire Chinese community in the United States gather together for this one event. For Peter Leung, it was like so shocking to me because I had never put politics and Chinese Americans in the same category in my sort of vision of what being an activist looked like.
One Chinese group organizing the protest of Leung's prosecution contacted Joanne Hardesty, the president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP.
And so there was this elderly Chinese community outrage saying that, well, Officer Leung was being singled out for prosecution. And when white men kill black men, they don't get tried. And therefore, Officer Leung shouldn't be tried. And I remember getting a phone call from a friend of mine who's a business owner in the Asian Pacific Islander community and said, we have this community elder who's organizing this protest. So it was like 2 days before somebody thought, well, maybe we ought to check in with the African-American community and see how this is going to play out.
Hardesty says she was taken aback that an Asian group would be protesting the sentencing of a police officer who shot an unarmed African-American man. During the phone call, she turned her disquiet into a conversation in which she listened but also explained her perspective.
I had to really intentionally listen deeply to what this gentleman was trying to say to me, because my initial instinct was to be outraged that he would want to defend the shooting and killing of an unarmed black man when it had been such an issue for the last couple of years. But I held my tongue. I listened deeply to what he had to say. I said to him, I'm concerned that this will be perceived as the Chinese community against the African American community. And then he says, well, you should come and speak.
Instead, Joanne Hardesty invited the Chinese American man to come to the next NAACP meeting.
And he did take me up on the offer. He did come to the NAACP meeting. We did have a conversation that was a bit heated, but respectful. And the good news is that he continues to come back, and he continues to be excited about the work that the NAACP is going. I made that story a lot longer than it needed to be to show you that I could have just said, This is racist, this is anti-black, and we're not having it. We don't want to be a part of it. We shouldn't have this conversation. But here's what happened when I had the same conversation. So after the conversation with the Chinese American Citizen Alliance, I emailed Joseph Lyons and said, have you heard about this rally?
Joseph Santos Lyons is APANO's executive director. After Hardesty contacted him, he led his organization to write a series of open letters in support of Black Lives Matter.
We took time to discuss internally within the organization about signing on to some public statements of support for Akai Gurley and really recognized the need for us to use this political moment to stand publicly and visibly out on the issue.
But the protests still went on in Portland.
I have no doubt that the Chinese American protests that happened downtown at Pioneer Square, despite some of the best intentions to build connections with the Black community, did create more division for us. And it portrayed, I think, the Asian American community largely as in opposition, maybe, to the interests of Black lives. I mean, frankly, I think there's tensions between all of our communities a lot of the time, and I think communities of color in general are pitted against each other in part to distract from the systems of oppression, the way whiteness and white supremacy and the way systems are designed to benefit white people at the expense of people of color really necessitates communities of color not getting along.
For Joanne Hardesty, the work of negotiating racial divides continues, especially in a city like Portland, where, according to the 2015 census, it's more than 80%.